Welcome to Sunday School. We are looking at one of your favorite people in history, Clotilda. I know you all woke up thinking about her this morning, didn't you? Well, she is an amazing lady. If you're familiar with her, you already know that. And if you don't know that, then I hope I can convince you that here is another of those women of God who shaped history. And I've been looking forward to this story about as much as any, but they're all wonderful. These are just great. I'm almost tempted to do this class again and take 12 other women who shaped history. Maybe I'll do that when I'm 80 and I'm done with Matthew. We'll see how that goes. But anyway, Clotilda, the short reason we're interested in her is because she was the wife of Clovis, who was a Frankish king who consolidated the region called Gaul such that eventually it became modern France. Okay, so she kind of had something very significant in history that paved the way to a great deal of the map of modern Europe that we take for granted these days. But her story doesn't stop there. It's really quite amazing beyond that. So let's think about her. The life verse that I've chosen for her, I hope she would agree with it. But at this point, you know, we're just going to go with it. This is from 1 Peter chapter 5. Wonderful reminder for all of us. And I think Clotilda may live this out as well as anybody I'm aware of in the history of the church. When Peter says, "Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, and that he can exalt you, that he will exalt you in due time. Cast all your care upon him, because he cares for you." That, isn't that great, a great statement all by itself? He cares for you. Let's just let that sink in a little bit. The God of the universe, who's sustaining a billion galaxies, cares about you. I don't know about you, but I'm glad to hear that. Let's have a word of prayer and we'll get started. Our Father, we are deeply grateful for all these remarkable people that pepper the history of your church and its work. And we pray that as we focus in on this young woman who had such a powerful impact, that we would do justice to her story and that we would take lessons from her that we can apply in our own lives, and all of that to the glory of Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen. So just a little bit about her. She was born in 474. We looked at Monica last week. She was the mother of Augustine, who died in 430. So we're about 50 years, give or take, down the road with the birth of Clotilda. She was born in Lyon, which of course eventually becomes part of France, but it wasn't that at the time. She is a Burgundian princess. Burgundy was one of those tribes scattered across northern Europe, which were called by the Romans barbarians. And so anyway, she's one of those. There's many others, of course. This is just simply one of them. The year 474 is somewhat important because historians will typically say that the Roman Empire finally fell, collapsed, kaput, 476. So we're just 2 years before that. Up until then, there was still a semblance of the empire, but it had so decayed, both from inside and also fell prey to the attacks from outside by these barbarians, that eventually she couldn't hold her own, and Rome basically collapsed back to one city and a little bit of real estate there in Italy. But this was it. So she's born right at that time, and the point of that is it was very tumultuous. Everything's up for grabs, and these barbarian tribes, as they're called, I use that term because it's commonly used, they weren't necessarily barbarians at all, you know, but these tribes were kind of fighting for real estate. So it's a time when there's a lot of internal contest going on, and that sort of thing is kind of the backdrop for the world in which she was born. I'm going to, in case you need a little refresher, This is Burgundy right down here. You can kind of see that right there. Gaul over here, what we would call France. Of course, France is bigger now, but at that time, that was Gaul. It was split up among several, and so was Burgundy. Burgundy had several different sub-tribes that were all part of that Burgundy ethnicity. So if that helps kind of get yourself oriented there. This is a region east of what we call France and pretty close to Switzerland. Her father was a fellow by the name of Chilperic II. His father was Chilperic I. I'm going to tell you a little secret. I've been working all week on the names. And I've almost got them. But if I trip around a little bit, you'll just forgive me. These are odd names. That's all I can say. In fact, Candy suggested earlier I should just give them normal names like Bob, Frank, and Ted, you know. But anyway, this is Chilperic II. Now, I have a little paren there that says he was Arian. And I want to explain that before we move on, because in some ways that, even though it seems a little technical maybe, will help us make sense out of the story of Clotilda. I appreciated Betsy's sermon this morning in which she repeatedly, I thought this is a great setup, you know, she repeatedly emphasized that Christ is two natures in one person, right? That is what we affirm. We are Orthodox Christian people, which means we subscribe to the Creed of Nicaea and the Creed of Chalcedon, 451. Those are the two main ones. There's others. And we believe that they do reflect accurately the teaching of the Bible. They don't replace the Bible, but we say they reflect what the Bible teaches. The heart of the matter is that Christ came into this world, Jesus of Nazareth, and he represents two distinct natures, deity and humanity. Now, we don't pretend to understand that. That is a bona fide mystery, just as the Trinity is a mystery. It's not contradictory, it's not absurd, it's not nonsense. But it is a little beyond us. And so we simply admit that. We just humbly acknowledge there's some things about God we don't get, you know. Maybe you got to be God to get it. But this is what he told us, and so we're going to live with that. We're just going to take it. If God says it, we assume it must be true. So here's part of this mystery. Christ is two natures. Now, in history, it's always made more sense to people to affirm one and neglect the other. That becomes more reasonable. Let's say Christ is God and kind of forget about his humanity. Or let's say Christ is man and kind of forget about his deity. Both of those make a lot more sense. And that's why heresies through the history of the church have always drifted in one of the two directions. It's hard to walk the tightrope, you see, and affirm both. Now, religions that tend to emphasize his deity and neglect his humanity tend to become otherworldly, mystical, isolationist. They tend, in some sense or other, to move into monasteries, either literal or metaphorical. They tend to step away. Everything important is heavenly. So heavenly minded, no earthly good. That's the old expression. That's kind of drifting one direction. The other direction, emphasizing his humanity over his deity, tends to create a religion that is this worldly, tends to depend on the implements of this world, the politics of this world, the devices of this world, and the weaponry of this world. Arianism stands generally as a generic term for religious movements that tend to emphasize Jesus' humanity and ignore his deity. Now, I say all that to say Chilperic was Arian. Many of these warring tribes were either pagan or Arian, because Arianism gave a justification for all kinds of bloodshed. If Jesus is strictly human, then it means he operates by human rules, and that means we go kill each other to expand our empires. Bottom line, you see. The ancient Jewish people were looking for a human Messiah, a great political leader, another David, son of David, who would come and drive out the Romans and establish an earthly political force. See, that was kind of the game in town at that point. Well, this is the kind of the same idea. Arianism, not surprisingly, was born out of a kind of misguided Judaism back first century, second century. All right, enough of that. So he rules from 473 to 486, at which time he was killed. We'll get to that in a minute. All right. Chilperic had two brothers. There were three sons of Chilperic the First, and the father, not wisely, just divided up his holdings among the three boys. This is not a good plan. It's a recipe for all kinds of rivalry and violence, and that's what happened. Now, the two other brothers are, we have Chilperic, then we have Gundabad. You remember his name because the last three letters are bad. He's a bad guy, okay? Then you have Godegisil. The first three letters of his name are G-O-D, God. He is a good guy. I'm not kidding. I think this is where Tolkien got his ideas for all the weird names in The Lord of the Rings. Honestly, I think so. So we got Chilperic, we got Gundabad, we got Godegisil. Gundabad and Chilperic are both Aryan. They're using that as a justification to fight each other. Godegisil, happily we report, was Trinitarian. Now, in the language of the day, he was Catholic. You know, that was the only game in town. And so we'll go with that. He was Catholic. He was Trinitarian. His little part of the pie was orderly. It was lovely. All reports indicate that he was a wonderfully generous man, the kind of Christian ruler you might expect to find, who was concerned about the poor, who had churches and bishops and sustained them and so on. And so he's kind of the one little piece of the puzzle that makes a little bit of sense. But the other two are just, you know, fighting each other and giving each other grief. So tension among the brothers. Outside of this Burgundy region are all other kinds of, you know, barbarian tribes, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Lombards, and so on. All of those guys are out there, and they're all saber-rattling. And so this is kind of the environment. It's kind of pretty, dicey. The mother of Clotilda was named Agrippina. Agrippina was Trinitarian. She was Catholic. So she's married to an Arian. She's a Catholic. He doesn't care. He's fine with that. You know, I mean, he's got his work to do. He's got a religion that suits his purposes. And if she runs a little kind of nice arrangement, for some reason, it didn't seem to bother him a bit. So mom is raising Clotilda in a Trinitarian, Orthodox, Catholic upbringing. And that's kind of the background now of her coming into this world. All right. Clotilda writes later about how deeply moved and impressed she was with the experience of worship. It's a distinct thing about her that she seems to have understood from a very early age, just the wonder of worshiping the true God. And that seems to have been a kind of a steady constant in her life all the way through. Her mother educated her in the Bible stories. She learned about David and Goliath, but she also learned about Jesus walking on the water. She had quite a deep education in the Bible, you know, for a child. And also she was very literate. So she was given a very good education from her mother, who was also an educated woman. Chilperic liked that. On one occasion, he was reported to have said, "The Romans treat us like barbarians. By golly, we want to be educated barbarians." Did I get that over to you okay? You know, it's supposed to be a passing quip. I didn't mean to butcher it, but you get the idea. He was a little proud. He was a Burgundian, and he thought, you know, we're as good as those Romans. They call us barbarians, but hey. So anyway, he was happy that his daughter was getting that education. There were Catholic bishops who served in that region. Like I say, Chilperic didn't mind that. So they ran worship, and on one occasion, Clotilda reports to us later that she asked this bishop, she worshiped in a Catholic setting, why there had to be so much conflict, so much bloodshed, so much violence. That was the world she lived in, just this constant threat. And he reportedly said to her, so she tells us later, that God would eventually bring truth and clarity. And she also made note that when he said that to her, he looked straight into her eyes. And that left a lasting impression. She's about 8 years old, you know. But he looked at her as if she were 38 years old. He looked at her as if she were fully an adult and gave her a very thoughtful answer. And it kind of touched me to read that later. I'll just tell you. We all have little kids. I have 19 grandkids, you know, and some of them are still kind of down there in that range. And to think the weight that you might have with some child. I know we love to see little kids play and we like to play, but to actually have a serious conversation with a child, to look into the eyes of a little child, and to let them know that at least for that moment, they are the center of your concern and you're treating them like a serious human being can have quite an effect. And I think Clotilda sort of learned that and really implemented that to some degree herself. All right. When Clotilda was 12 years old, there was a power struggle going on among the three brothers. Now, the one brother, Godegisil, was kind of staying out of it. He just wanted to mind his own shop. But the other two were threatening him and threatening each other. And Gundabad, bad guy, swoops in and murdered in a violent attack, both the mother and the father of Clotilda. 12 years old, Uncle Gundabad comes in, takes over that area. Of course, I don't have to tell you the trauma that would be. She's living at a violent time, and so I suppose, given that, she always knew something like that could happen, but even at that, you know, how can you possibly survive it? Well, there was a bishop there in that region, and I think he, realizing the delicacy of the situation, kind of took Clotilda under wraps, spirited her away out from under this attack. Of course, Gundabad takes over all of his holdings now. That's what he wanted. It was a land grab. And so he takes it. But somehow Clotilda escapes over to Uncle Godegisil, 12 years old. He is in Geneva. All right? Map. Geneva's not on the map, but just so you kind of get it. She's been down here in Burgundy. Geneva would be right about there where I'm pointing, so kind of the upper edge of that territory that's part of Burgundy. So she's just kind of spirited up there, and she winds there a little bit like a refugee, you know, showing up. And there she is for some years. Godegisil, uncle, is Trinitarian. All accounts are he's a true Christian. He loves Jesus. He wants worship to be done rightly. He's known for his charity. He's a good guy. And he takes her in happily or extends all kinds of warm affection to her, giving her assurances that this is an ugly situation for her to lose both her parents violently like that. Nevertheless, she should, and this was his counsel to her, she should now assume that Jesus is her father. She's 12 years old. And he says, you need to understand that though, you know, these things have happened, God in heaven is watching you, and Jesus himself is the Father you can trust. And she took that to heart. And so these few years were really healing for her as much as they could be. She, for whatever it was worth, loved Geneva. She thought Geneva was a wonderful place, and she would have lived there, I suppose, forever. But Gundabad, emphasis on bad, says, nope, Clotilda, I want you back here. Now, by this time, she's mid-teens, maybe 16 years old. Why does he want her? Well, because he wants to consolidate his legitimacy. He came in there violently, a lot of bloodshed. Now he wants to hold himself out as the legit ruler, and one way to do that is to get the daughter of the dead brother back into his world so he's not meaning any harm to her. Obviously, she doesn't have a lot of affection for Uncle Gundabad, you know, but she doesn't really have many options. He is at this point in a position to kind of call the shots. And so there she is now in her late teenage years for a couple of years back in the home of Gondabad and trying to just stay, you know, low profile. That's what she's doing. All right, now we're going to switch over to Clovis. While this is all happening, just next door, we have Clovis, who's in the world of Gaul. It's called Gaul at that time. Modern-day France. These are Frankish tribes. And so Clovis, at 15 years old, the year 481, at this point, Clotilde is about 8 or 9 years old, you know, he becomes king of the Franks, one of them. Again, you have a similar kind of thing. Dad dies, divides his world up into 3 sons. I don't know where they got this idea, but he does the same thing that we had over in Burgundy. And so once again, you have 3 different kind of fiefdoms, you might say, there, divvying up life among the Franks. Clovis himself, I'll just give you this, ruled from 481, 15 years old, until he was about 40 or so, the year 511. So that's about 30-year reign or so. All right, just one more time, just to keep us oriented. So he's over here, and he's way up at the top. So he's ruling in what today would be Belgium, kind of that idea, but this is the entire region. So he's holding kind of a smaller piece of a pretty big pie at the beginning. And so that's where his holdings start. Clovis is not Arian. He's not Trinitarian. He is pagan. And he's pagan in a big way. He maintains that he was descended from the gods. He thinks he's a little bit of a god himself. He's 15 years old, you know. I've met 15-year-olds like that. And he was really, you know, he was just full of himself. And he was really determined that though he was way up there, he was way up there in the corner, he was going to spread his holdings. He was going to prove something. And so he, at 21 years old, consolidates some power. And he attacks out of the blue a guy by the name of Syagrius. Why? Took me about 45 attempts to get that. So there it is. He attacks Syagrius. Now, Syagrius, this was a land grab. You know, Clovis thinks he deserves it because he's descended from the gods. So what are you going to do? You go take stuff from people. Syagrius was a leftover Roman. He was actually Roman ethnicity. When Rome collapsed, 476, he was able to muster a little piece of real estate. He's Trinitarian, as many of the Romans were by this time. He was a Christian. And so anyway, he was there minding his own business. This was an unprovoked attack by Clovis, swooping in. It's the Battle of Soissons. How do they do that? You know? Anyway, I think it's pronounced something like that. He had Catholic bishops. He had a very orderly society. He was a little bit like Gojadazil. He was kind of the same sort of a ruler, and he was had this kind of small fiefdom, you might say, that was operating in that region. It was a Christian. He had churches, he had bishops and priests and so on. And when Clovis came in and attacked, you might have thought he would have wanted to destroy all of the religion. But I think for the first time he realized, you know, this isn't bad. These people are living orderly lives. They drive the speed limit. They're not at each other's throats. They kind of have a, you know, he didn't know to call it a Christian ethic, but he knew that maybe he should just leave well enough alone here. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And this looked pretty good. And so all he did was kind of swap rulers. They did have Syagrius. Now they have Clovis. But otherwise, you can keep on living your lives the way it has been. He just doesn't upset the apple cart. I think that's the first time it dawned on him that there might be a different way to do this. But it didn't have an immediate effect. But at least I think he made a little mental note of that. The major bishop that ruled there under Syagrius and who survived this attack was a priest by the name of Avitus. Now, some have speculated that Avitus may have already been thinking a little bit of a matchmaker role here. He knew that Clotilda was at least the right age to maybe get paired up with Clovis. He knew that Clovis was pagan. Clotilda, he knew, was Christian. And yet he also thought this might just work out. Now, we don't know if he was thinking about this yet, but some historians have speculated to that. He certainly played a role later, which leads us to think maybe he had something like that in his mind. Anyway, as it turned out, in 493, Clovis visits Gundobad. Now remember, these two are side by side. You've got Gaul and you've got the Burgundy region, and Clovis has no designs to attack eastward. He wants to consolidate Gaul, and he wants to make sure he's not exposed to any unexpected problems from his east, that is the region of the Burgundy. So he actually went over to cut a deal to see if they could work out some kind of arrangement between them that would mean he didn't have to worry about an unexpected attack from the east, and he could focus on his own conquistatorial designs going south. Well, he visited there, and he noticed this attractive young late teenage gal, kind of keeping by herself, but she was obviously part of the court, and he noticed her. He didn't have any contact with her that we're aware of. I don't think they went on a date or anything like that. He just kind of was there, basically negotiating with Gundobad, but he at least made a mental note. I think the Latin for what he thought in his mind was something like, it was something like, va, va, boom. It was something like that when he saw, you know, I think that crossed his mind. Anyway, he did strike a deal with Gundobad. So Clovis and Gundobad have this relationship. Soon thereafter, however, he sent a message back to Gundobad asking for Clotilda's hand in marriage. Seems a little precipitous, but that's the way it did. It was going to be a political marriage. It was Clovis's way to hopefully secure, by way of a political marriage, his relationship with Gundobad, because now they were going to be related, you know. So that's what he had primarily in mind. But by the same token, he was sort of attracted to her, so it looked pretty good for that reason as well. Well, when the message came to Clotilda, 19 years old now, she was really shocked, number one. She was hoping to stay way under the radar, you know, and this all of a sudden was going to kind of catapult her into the public eye. She was also distinctly aware that Clovis thought he was a god. And that didn't set well with her theology, you know, and so she just kind of wondered, what are the prospects for this relationship? She wasn't really sure this was going to work out too well. This is where Bishop Avitus shows up. I said maybe he'd already had this in his mind, but now I don't know whether he sent her an email or what, but somehow or other, he was able to make contact with her, and he really did urge her to accept this invitation. In some ways, she didn't have a choice. If Gundobad said it, it would be done, but I think he didn't, after what he'd done to her parents, I don't think he wanted to force the issue. So Avitus stepped in and told her that she should accept this, not because there was any great love in her heart necessarily, not from ambition, not from any of that, but because she was a Christian. And maybe it just might be that even her Christian, you know, faith could play a role here that maybe even she couldn't quite foresee. So at 19 years old, she's getting that sort of counsel from Avitus, and she agreed. So there's a big transfer. You know how they did it in the ancient world? There's a border that separates Burgundy here from Gaul there, and so they're all the people from Burgundy bring her to the border and hand her off to all of the people who've come to meet her from the other side. Kind of a big deal, you know, kind of a transfer, and she's handed over to the Gallic tribes and the representatives of Clovis and taken back, and the marriage takes place soon thereafter. So now we have Clotilda 19 married to Clovis 27. This began as simply an expression of political gymnastics, but it does seem the best evidence is that Clovis really did want to win her heart. He, you know, whatever we may think of him otherwise, I think he really did have some pretty immediate and deep affection for her. And he didn't want her to just feel like she was being forced into a relationship. And so he really kind of went out of her way, out of his way to win her. And she was willing to be won. You know, let's just put it that way. She saw this as an opportunity. And so they did seem to have a pretty solid relationship, as unlikely as it might appear right off the bat. The wedding itself was a magnificent affair. She told him right off the bat, you know, husband, I'm going to be praying for you. I mean, she was quite upfront about that. And he said, that's fine, sweetie, but you need to understand I'm descended from the gods. You know, he just wanted to get that on the table. So they were kind of miles apart theologically, but there was something there, I think, of a true, genuine affection for one another. Clotilda was in a very different world. The Gallic tribes were much less sophisticated than the Burgundians. So she was sort of back into more of a third world, you might say, in our language situation than she had been accustomed to. She felt kind of alone because all of her friends were back there, you know how it is, and now she's by herself in this new place. So it's kind of a rude, different, jarring situation culturally, and that's what she's being exposed to. Clovis, for him, his part, knew this. And she tells something later, a very interesting thing, that on their wedding night, he gave her a ring. This is not a wedding ring, but he gave her a ring, quite expensive, that matched the color of her eyes. It's kind of a touching idea. You know, he'd already made mental note of this. And that was sort of the typical way that he treated her very well. He was a real gentleman. I think all the records seem to indicate that for her. He was a jerk otherwise, but with her, he was kind of a good guy. She kept that forever as a keepsake, and even later in her life, she still had that ring and valued it very deeply. He also gave her several towns. He said, look, I'm a warrior. I might die in battle. I mean, I am a descendant from the gods, but I am mortal. I am going to die. And he knew that could happen, and so he actually gave her what we would call a little life insurance. He gave her several towns. They were hers outright. The tax revenue would be hers, and if he died, those towns would continue to support her. That may strike us as odd to do that. We're going to see a story later of an Elizabeth who was also married to a king who died, and the next day she was out. She was out on the streets, just like that. The death of her husband was the death of her life. And so it didn't always happen this way, but he knew that was a risk and he wanted to provide for her. So that's what he did. All right. There's a Christian chaplain there. He encouraged Clotilda and really was encouraging her to continue to pray for him. And so she, for her part, was exemplary. She did frequently go down into the marketplace. She interacted with the normal people, not something you always did when you were royalty, but nevertheless, she was happy to do that. And he noticed it. Clovis noticed that, you know, there was no arrogance about her. She wasn't trying to come off as something special. He made note of that. Interesting thing happened. They were married about a year later. They had their first child. Their first child was born a little premature, was not healthy, and died shortly after birth, which, of course, was a heartbreak for Clotilda. You can imagine that. Some of you have been through something like that. And Clovis, not one of his better moments, said, you know, maybe this God you worship, this Christian God, ain't all he's cracked up to be. I mean, look, here's this baby you were, you know, he just, it was a hurtful thing. I don't think he said it cruelly. I think he was just trying to observe that, you know, these things happen. Well, anyway, a year later, a second child was born. This was a little healthier. Clotilda saw that immediately on birth, this child was baptized. Of course, baptism was a huge thing, according to them, to us as well. And so she wanted that child to be baptized immediately, which he was. That child also fell ill. Very ill. And again, Clovis is kind of standing back and saying, kind of like an I told you so kind of deal. And again, Clotilda prayed earnestly with weeping at the side of that child. And within a day or two, the child seemed to have recovered. That's the story. And Clovis noticed that. You know. And it made a little mental note that maybe he'd been a little precipitous. And so, in any event, that was part of the early marital experience that they had. All right. Battle of Tolbiac. This is in 496. There was a fellow named Alamanni. He was in a separate tribe, not part of the Gallic tribes or Burgundian, but kind of up to the north. He came in his own land grab to swoop in. It was a surprise attack. Well, you always know this can happen if you're ruling a region, you know. So you're always kind of in a state of readiness. But nevertheless, there was no advance warning. So immediately, Clovis mustered the army that was available to him, and he went out. And the record was that he was facing a much larger force than he could muster on short order to meet this guy. The battle took place some miles away, and he just rode into the battle, leading the men that he could, and they went into this battle. Of course, everybody's staying home, Clotilda and all of the people at home, waiting there, biting their nails, hoping, you know, for good news. And as the day waxes on, pretty soon toward evening, a horseman comes riding back into the community saying, "It's over, we lost. Clovis himself is probably dead." That was kind of the first, and everybody's just heartbroken, you know, because what does this mean? Well, nobody knows what it means. But losing in a battle in that situation, you know it's not going to be the same as it always has been. A later historian summarizes the record of this incident that's recorded for us I'm blanking on his name. There's a historian who gives, Gregory of Tours, that's the guy. Gregory of Tours is the first historian of this. A later historian is summarizing the record from Gregory of Tours. So I'm quoting a later historian, but it's based on Gregory. And this is what he writes. So this first horseman has arrived and said, "Bad news, we're losing, Clovis is probably dead," on his heels, picking up here. But then another horse arrived at full gallop. A royal guardsman was trying to catch up with the bearer of bad news. There had been a complete reversal that the guardsman himself had witnessed. He was right there near the king. He says, "At the height of the battle, encircled and desperate, Clovis had suddenly lifted his hands to heaven and shouted, 'God of Clotilda, if you give me this victory, I will myself be baptized.'" This is like foxhole evangelism, you know? An artist, I mentioned him last week, Ari Scheffer, painted a picture of this moment of church history, painted this in 1836, capturing what he envisioned was the moment in which there's Clovis, desperate, arm extended into heaven, crying out for the help of the God of Clotilda. This man reported everything reversed. Virtually at that moment, an arrow took out Alamanni. He was dead. The defeat was transformed into brilliant victory. When Clovis returned sometime later, he immediately spoke of his desire to be baptized as soon as possible. You know, this was transformation on the spot. Well, it did happen. He announced his... Now, he was not sure. You know, he'd always told his fighting men that he was descended from the gods, and they'd always followed him on that premise. And now he thinks to himself, "Okay, I don't know how these guys are going to respond when I tell them I've just become a Christian. I'm not descended from the gods. I'm a depraved guy like everybody else. You know, I'm like, what are you going to do with your men if they hear that and don't like it very much?" But he was so persuaded of this that he did tell them that. He stood up in front of all of the people and all of the soldiers and so on that served under him. And there was immediately, the record is just this mass cheering, kind of a mass conversion, you know, that all of them just kind of rallied to this unlikely preacher, Clovis, a new convert himself, now making this report. At Christmas, There was a great profession, a procession, I should say, with Clovis, with the nobles, with the family. There was a great baptism in which Clovis was baptized. This was a couple of months later. And all of these others, many hundreds came in to the church at that point through baptism. It was quite a turning point. The day was followed, of course, as you can imagine, by joy, feasting, worship. I'm going to summarize later history because it's noon, and I always try to stop right around noon and allow some time for interaction. So I'm going to give you kind of the short version here of what happened. There was a later battle. This was in 507 with a guy named Alaric. He was a Visigoth. It's called the Battle of Valais. In it, Clovis was victorious. This was probably the last major battle he had, and he was able to consolidate all of Gaul. That map I showed you earlier, he really was able to take control of all of that. As a result, he established a capital in Paris. He built a cathedral there for Catholic worship at the time. It really did represent the great consolidation, you might say, of authority there in all of what eventually would become France. He died in 511. Interestingly, he did not die in a battle. He died of pneumonia. He was 40 years old. But by the way, 40 years old was actually an older guy in those days, you know, especially if you were a warring king. So that was not all that unusual. He, big mistake, divided his holdings among his four sons. You know, but anyway, Clotilda, these are the four sons of Clotilda. And she carried some weight in the family, I'm going to tell you. And so instead of these guys just ripping to each other to shreds, she played a pretty significant role in mediating disputes. Mom has shown up, you know, and so she kept these guys kind of from turning what was a tense situation into an ugly one, and you never did have the kind of warfare going on that had been characteristic of earlier times. Eventually, Clotilda moved to Tours. For the rest of her life, she was well provided for because Clovis had made those provisions. She spent her resources building churches, establishing monasteries. She was really, the universal record was well known for her really genuine Christian character and so on. She lived to be a mother and grandmother, always involved in the family politics, and in some ways the reason that Gaul hung together in spite of this four-way split was because of her intervention along the way. Her focus was always trying to instill a Christian quality among those with whom she had to do. She died in 545 in Tours. Revered universally for her devotion to Christ and the strategic role that she had played along the way. She was buried in Paris alongside Clovis there and later canonized by the Catholic Church as a saint. Her feast day is on June 3rd, if you want to just make a little note of that. And so that is Clotilda, one of my favorite ladies of church history, and I think we can safely say she was a woman of God who shaped history. Sunday school lesson, back to her life verse, at least that's what I'm giving her. Humble yourself. She was a humble woman. That is the universal testimony. There was never a trace of sort of the arrogance of position. Of course, she'd been through some painful things. What her psychology was, how she endured that, I think we have to just resort back to faith that carried her through. God exalted her in due time. She became one of the most famous, really legendary human beings of the day. And her death was universally celebrated across the world by people who recognized the quality of her. She did, in fact, cast her cares, and there were plenty of them, onto Christ, who she always kind of viewed as her father. So, my friends, my thoughts for us this morning, first and chief quality of Christian character is humility, as the heart of our sinfulness is pride. A snake told some people in a garden, eat this apple and you're going to be like God. And for a while, Clovis believed it. He thought he was a god. And it was the influence of circumstances and his wife that taught him a different lesson. I hate to tell you this, maybe I'm just speaking to myself, but we all have, at least I think we all have this little impulse that we kind of envy God, you know? We want to be the one in charge. Heaven forbid. But the happiest, best thing we can do is to just set it aside. How many times does the New Testament tell us, consider others better than yourself? Jesus washes the feet. I hope that when I come in here and teach Sunday school, that the attitude that I have in my mind is I'm just washing your feet. You know, I want to be a servant. That's how we should be with each other. I'm not very good at it, but let's all work toward that. Humble yourself. And in fact, the great corollary is that the richest experience of honor for a Christian is that which comes from God. When I honor myself, it's cheap, empty, vapid, worthless. When I humble myself and God exalts, that's a very different deal, isn't it? God who promises to exalt us as we disclaim any attempt to exalt ourselves. How many of the world's ills would be solved if we just lived a little bit by that? And finally, the deepest confidence in the heart of a Christian is the promise that God cares for us. He cares for you, and we can trust him. If you were the only human being in the universe, if you were the only human being that existed, God wouldn't care for you any more than he cares for you right now. This infinite deity is nevertheless so great that he can let you be the centerpiece of his concern. And so why shouldn't we relax, friends? Why shouldn't we relax? If the God of heaven and earth cares for you, then why do we care so much about taking care of ourselves as opposed to simply trusting him? I think that's the message we get from Clotilda, and I hope it's one we can take to heart. And I'm done. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. I do appreciate it very much. Thank you. Well, I appreciate it. Let's have a word of prayer and all that. Let's go. Our Father, we are deeply grateful for this remarkable woman who was, as we've just been reminded, only a teenager when some of these great things happened. And we're grateful for her example, for the legacy she left to all of us. We thank you for so many others that we've never heard of and yet who have had a similar kind of opportunity to serve you. We pray that we would take to heart the things that are useful and apply them in such a way that Christ is honored, asking this in his name. Amen.